Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
The Cannonball is part of the Agora Podcast Network. If you enjoy our show, then be sure to check out some of the others on the network, like The History of England, a chronological walk through, well, the history of England. This isn't a dry events-only podcast, but one that takes its time to meander through the customs and cultures that make the history of the UK funny, if not fascinating. For more information on the show, check out thehistoryofengland.co.uk, and for more information on the shows on the network, go to agorapodcastnetwork.com. And if you want more of The Cannonball, check out our blog at thecannonballpodcast.wordpress.blog. You'll see our occasional scribblings on canonical things, as well as the order in which we're tackling the canon. You can also find us on Twitter at Cannonball Pod, or on Facebook if you look for our group. Rate and review on iTunes. Thanks, and enjoy the show. Welcome to The Cannonball, a podcast attempt to read all of the books in Harold Bloom's list of the Western canon. My name is Claude Myron Guzer, and with me is my co-host, Daniel Doherty. Daniel, how are you doing?
Hey, very good. I am doing much better than the last time we attempted to record this episode. So, folks, to still get a little peek behind the curtain here, this is our second attempt at talking about the third book of Montaigne's essays, the last of them. We're rounding out Montaigne. And earlier in the week, Claude and I were both coming off of some head colds. The technical gods were not in our favor. We limped along and recorded. We still recorded a solid hour's worth of material where we got excited and we talked about stuff, but it just ended up being totally unusable. So we're back because you know what? Because the listeners, Claude, deserve the very best that we can muster. Well, so
you know, it was a combination of lack of sleep on my part and lack of technical, I guess, facility. And you had some brilliant stuff to say on the French civil wars of religion that I couldn't hear.
Yeah, I really got into my zone too. I was like, I would go on for like 2 or 3 minutes and then be like, hey, Claude, did you actually get any of that? Or am I, you know, and then he'd be like, oh yeah, no, I get you cut out like 2 minutes ago. So this is our attempt to recapture that magic and actually, I think, generate some actual new magic, because we've had some more time to chew on stuff. We've had some more time to reflect on the text, to think about the things that we actually wanted to talk about. So I'm excited. I'm ready to jump in, man.
So we read all of book three, but figured that it would be the best and easiest to focus on three particular essays that are sort of the standalones of that book. The essay on Virgil, the essay on physiognomy, and the essay on experience. Okay, the essay on Virgil is about anything but Virgil. Montaigne takes as his starting point a couple of lines. I mean, that's sort of what it is, an essay on a couple of lines of Virgil. But particularly, he's picking on a couple of the ways that Virgil depicts marriage among the gods. His problem with the way Virgil writes about it is that, well, I guess it comes closer to an idealized version of marriage, which involves sexual desire and partnership. Okay, we'll get to that in a second. The second essay on physiognomy has to do with the way people look, but it's fascinating because it's, at least from my read of this whole way through, it's the closest Montaigne comes to really addressing the political fractures of his day.
Right. I'm sure he must have written, about this, you know, the actual political situation in his life and times in, you know, some other works, or certainly in diplomatic letters that he would have been sending back and forth. But this is really the only of the essays that really, that he couldn't not talk about it.
Yeah, and it's really fascinating for what it says about a state of political chaos. To be as human as possible, I found it comforting.
Yeah.
To think about another person experiencing a moment where it looked as if the nation state, or the certainties of the nation state, or the certainties that he'd grown up with, were about to be just utterly demolished.
Yeah.
There was something in that was a little bit comforting. How does one stare down the disintegration of a social order?
Yeah.
I don't think it was necessarily – I don't think it's necessarily the view that I would endorse. But there was something admirable about certain of the claims that he made.
Yeah.
And then we're going to get to On Experience, which is the foundation for both Emerson and Nietzsche. The epistemology that he lays out is what becomes it's what I just said. It's the foundation for Emerson and Nietzsche.
Yeah.
For both of them, it's ironic because both of those two later writers were so intent on expressing the individuality of the writer. Mm-hmm. And both of them are blatantly ripping off Montaigne. I mean, it's astounding to me how close Emerson, who had this intense anxiety about being original, sounds to Montaigne. And that's what I think is fascinating about Montaigne by the end is I really do feel like I don't know if this is accurate at all, because there's so much – there's a field of distortion between actual person and text. Mm-hmm. There's a field of distortion between readership and text. There are all these different ways to get at this, but I really do feel like by the end of the very last essay, Montaigne kind of didn't care. He cared about how he would be viewed. He cared. I mean, this is all a construct. I mean, the essays, the persona that he developed, it's all a construct. He cared to an extent about how it would be viewed, but there's something that he sort of lets go of to say, look, let's just really address what it means to be human. Let's really just sort of address all of these complicated things that humanity means. And break it down, think about it, work through it, accept it. And I don't think he had the anxiety about individuality that Emerson had to an intense degree and that Nietzsche had to an even more intense degree.
Right. A full neurosis of individuality when it comes to Nietzsche, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Montaigne is just sort of like, hey, here's what I think it is to be. Mm-hmm. Let me lay it out on the table. Let's take it and move with it. And then Emerson and then Montaigne and then Nietzsche after him just took that as something much more anxious. Mm-hmm. I don't feel a kind of anxiety over personality in Montaigne. In fact, I feel the opposite.
Right. Well, I was going to say, like, as you know, as Emerson has this anxiety about individuality and whatnot, it seems Montaigne he's blasé about whatever individuality emerges in these essays, and you know, part of me might have to think that for those later writers, of course, they are, as much as Montaigne is conscientious of the fact that he is in conversation with writers who came before him, and I mean, you know, you read the essays and it's chock full of this humanist citation of the classics everywhere. That's his whole shtick this whole entire time has been, I'm going to be in dialogue with the classics and it's going to take me off in these little directions and here you go. But I think perhaps your later thinkers like Emerson and Nietzsche were more self-conscious about the fact that they were self-conscious about being in conversation with people who discovered an individuality themselves, I guess.
Yeah. And okay. There's something else in Montaigne that that recognizes the unknowability of individuality. Mm-hmm. Like there's something in Montaigne that recognizes that your actual true self is to some capacity unknowable. That part of what he's doing is laying out this whole project to be able to say, oh, so here's who I am. Mm-hmm. And he keeps surprising himself by who he is. All right. I'm going to read a message that was sent to me by a friend of mine who I want to pimp for 5 minutes. Arturo Zillarulo. If anybody is interested at all in contemporary poetry, please look this guy up. His last name is spelled Zillerulo, and I'm doing my damnedest to try to talk him into maybe coming on and talking to us about Romanticism. He's a colleague of mine from grad school, and he's a poet himself. He's written a book that is frustratingly good. Yeah. It's irritatingly good because he wrote a book of poems that it annoys me how good it is. But he likes our podcast and he's been talking to me back and forth, and he wrote me a message that points out the uncanny weirdness of Montaigne talking about his mind. Art says, I think my favorite of his images is from the essay on idleness when he describes his mind as a runaway horse that gives birth to chimeras. The mind beholding itself and acknowledging its inability to know and control all its disparate parts is genuinely scary. Art's right, but he's also wrong. Well, not wrong, but there's also this sense that it's fascinating that the mind is this thing that when you sort of let it loose, you can control it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's another sort of fascinating aspect of Montaigne. This is all, you know, I don't think we talked about it about this, but the way he's considering the essay is in that French sense of essay. Like, it's not just this long, boring thing that you write for Dr. Guzer when he's teaching you your stupid English 110 class. Right. It's an attempt. It's an essay.
It's a sally forth. Yeah,
exactly. So there's this way in which it's a sally forth, not just to let loose all of your thoughts and opinions, but to actually know
who and what you are. So to get back to the third book, what does Montaigne know about marriage? Well,
it's not terrible, is the thing. I have a kind of this is the On Some Lines of Virgil essay that, you know, Claude mentioned earlier. He's taking as a taking off point this Virgil's description of like the perfect marriage between God beings or whatever, and that it is in Virgil's telling it is chock full of eros. You know, it is rapturous, romantic abandon. And Montaigne's like, wait a minute. I have a, you know, through my, you know, I have a different take on this. And there's a particular paragraph that I think, you know, sums it up pretty well, as well as you can sum up anything in Montaigne. What he says here, a good marriage, if there be any such, am I right, fellas? Okay. A good marriage, if there be any such, rejects the company and the conditions of love and tries to represent those of friendship. 'Tis a sweet society of life, full of constancy, trust, and an infinite number of useful and solid services and mutual obligations, which any woman who has a right taste would be loath to serve her husband in quality of a mistress. If she be lodged in his affection as a wife, she is more honorably and securely placed. When he purports to be in love with another, and works all he can to obtain his desire, let any one but ask him, on which he had rather a disgrace should fall, his wife or his mistress, which of their misfortunes would most afflict him, and to which of them he wishes the most grandeur? The answer to these questions is out of dispute in a sound marriage. So Montaigne there is postulating this, and again, we have to, you know, reflect on the fact that he's talking about marriage from the standpoint of a kind of middle-ranking aristocrat of the 16th century in France, which is a social milieu very, I would say, very alien to my own. I can't speak for Claude, but at the same time, I think he's hitting upon something, because it's interesting that what he's hit upon is kind of what we might, it's kind of like half of the sort of modern day ideal companionate marriage, isn't it? He's postulating this union based on reciprocal trust and support more than eros.
Yeah, and he's got this idea that in one of the earlier essays that I think we briefly touched on friendship, he's describing his friendship with Etienne, the poet who died, and that was sort of like this intense friendship, which was in many ways coming close to an eroticization, but then gets de-eroticized. And there seems to be this de-eroticized version of marriage that's much more pragmatic that he has in mind. It's weird because it views marriage not exactly as a mercenary position, mm-hmm. but with some of the considerations that an idealization wouldn't take into account.
Yeah, it's interesting that you're right. It's not the strictly mercenary arrangement, which, you know, would not have been uncommon. Our classical understanding of the aristocratic marriage as a kind of a tool of estate management, essentially.
That's what it was.
Yeah, and so it's not as strictly mercenary as that. It's practical, but also I think what's most interesting is that I think it sort of centers around, and I don't know enough of my French to know just what kind of shades of meaning there are in the differences between the words love and friendship, because you know, you'll know in the Latin and the Romance languages, you know, words for friendships, you know, like of course in French would be like ami or whatever, but you know, amiable, things like that. Those are etymologically related to the words for love, and it would not have been uncommon to talk about love between friends and things like that. I think what he's getting at is more like there's still a love element. It's just not that the erotic element of love is not the ascendant here. It is this kind of this companionate love, and you know, to which would be, he doesn't say anything about an erotic component to this ideal marriage, which is, I think, where he differs from, I guess, what sort of the modern conception of the ideal marriage is, where the people engaged in it are each other's, you know, primary, you know, focus of those kinds of, I don't know quite how to put it, libidinal sort of attitudes. But he does, I think, how did I put it? I think he's hit upon, though, this kind of, he's hit upon the idea of the companionate, woke, polyamorous marriage, like open marriage.
It's all right. This is to go somewhere stupid to come back to somewhere, I suppose, a little bit more intellectual, but not really. But the in the Venture Brothers, do you know the Venture Brothers?
I do.
Cartoon.
Yeah.
I really have an affection for the Venture Brothers. I think it was made literally just for me. I am the only person on earth to get 99.9% of the jokes and references. But in one of the commentaries, yeah, I'm a dork. But in one of the commentaries, they mention that one of the, like, the main supervillain is the backstory that came up for him was he has an open relationship with his wife, but she has all these affairs on the side and he can't manage to get one.
Right.
That's sort of the silliness that comes up with a sort of, like, I guess, angst open marriage, where there's still this commodification.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah. A lot of this depends on the, I guess we're coming at this from a late capitalist version of thinking about economies, but there's this commodification of sex and sexuality that mm-hmm. views the woman as, or either the woman or certain kinds of sexual activities, as commodities to be obtained or
somehow,
yeah,
somehow as part of some transaction.
Yeah. And he's not exactly thinking about it like that. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I found sort of fascinating about this, okay, not fascinating from a 21st century perspective, but fascinating that someone in his time would be thinking about this, mm-hmm. is his equality of all this. All right. Last episode, we were really sort of talking about Montaigne's problem, or the problems that we sort of had with some of the ways that he was interpreting no to mean yes. Mm-hmm. And I still find that extraordinarily problematic. I'm not going to back off of that. I have a hard time cordoning that off as, well, that was just his time. No, it's still a pervasive discourse even today. And it's a damaging discourse even today.
Yeah.
But what I find kind of interesting about the essay on Virgil is the way that he really sort of addresses the double standards. The way that, okay, he doesn't exactly back off of the 16th century idea that women want sex more than men.
Yeah, that was, I guess that's something that is, that's sort of, opposite to a lot of the, I guess what we might call traditional assumptions in our day and age, where it is men who are presumed to be uncontrollably libidinal at all times, and it's up to women to resist them.
Right.
Yeah.
And he still sort of carries that chauvinism into, or that stereotype into his writings. But what he does sort of admit to is the double standard there, mm-hmm. that, well, men also want sex and go to all these sort of extremes to have this thing, Well, wouldn't it be easier to just admit that sex and sexuality are a part of existence? It's a part of being human. It's fun. Let's find a way to navigate this reasonably, carefully, so that nobody gets hurt and that we all manage to maintain whatever human dignity we have.
Right.
Let's be frank and unembarrassed about this stuff and just let's talk. There's this way in which he's addressing this. It's not exactly on the level of equality, but it's acknowledging the hypocrisy on the part of men. And that's what I found really sort of fascinating about this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Yeah.
By the way, if I can help it, this is the very last time that I'm going to read one of these texts on a Kindle. I've got an iPad from school that they gave me for this class that I'm teaching, and it's the worst thing possible. Yeah. Reading on a Kindle. All right, let me break in with my own humanist.
Let's go Montaigne for a moment.
My own analyses. And I was actually talking to a friend of mine about this, that reading on a Kindle is a completely different experience. When mm-hmm. you read in an actual book and underline an actual book and take notes in an actual book, there's a kind of spatial awareness that is extraordinarily different from reading online, mm-hmm. where everything seems to be endless. There's a kind of welcome finality to an actual physical text. And the reason I ended up reading this on a Kindle is because Montaigne's book is very, very heavy.
Yes.
That's pretty much it. Otherwise, I wouldn't be reading it like this. But yeah, it's kind of terrible. And so I've got all these weird sort of underlines and highlights and notes. And I hate every minute of it because it's sort of endless. But anyway, I think I can find some of those moments where Montaigne is writing about either this hypocrisy or the sort of expectations that are ridiculous. Okay, mm-hmm. I want to go to something extraordinarily silly first to come back. One of the things that he thinks is problematic about not talking bluntly about sex and sexuality is that we get all kinds of unrealistic expectations. And I know there are a lot of sex educators and sex positive people that were really troubled by 50 Shades of Grey, not necessarily for the BDSM content, though they sort of objected to the way that the BDSM content was treated unrealistically, but also to the ways that sex in general were treated unrealistically. I think the protagonist, the main character, at the moment of penetration had her first orgasm. It was sort of like, yeah, well, let's be, you know, a little, I guess, realistic about this. Yeah. Montaigne is bothered by the fact that the graffiti that the French youth put up is so unrealistic. And it makes perhaps women who are unaccustomed to actual male genitalia expect something different. He says, what great harm is done by those graffiti of enormous genitals which boys scatter over the corridors and staircases of our royal palaces? From them arise a cruel misunderstanding of our natural capacities. Who knows whether that explains why Plato decreed, following the practice of other states with sound institutions, that both men and women, old and young, should appear naked before each other during exercises in the gymnasia. Those Indian women who see their men in the nude have at least cooled off their visual senses. So, you know, it's really problematic that boys are drawing these extraordinarily large penises all over the place, because it really sets women up to think, wow, all penises must be like this.
right. I personally can't wait to see a crudely drawn penis.
But that gets back to all right, so that's me being a little bit silly, but yeah, that gets back to Montaigne's claims for honesty.
Yeah, and to that, I found the passage I was thinking of.
Can I interrupt you with another passage first?
Please do.
Okay. I'm sorry. Thinking about his honesty and his claims for honesty, what he really sort of wants is self-knowledge. And this seems to me to be a Platonic thing. The more you know yourself, the better. He's talking about why he's talking about such, I guess, outre material. And he says, God grant that my excessive license may draw men nowadays to be free, rising above those cowardly counterfeit virtues which are born of our imperfections, and also grant that I may draw them to the pinnacle of reason at the expense of my own lack of moderation. If you are to tell of a vice of yours, you must first see it and study it. Those who conceal it from others usually do so from themselves as well. They hold that it is not sufficiently hidden if they can see it, so they disguise it and steal it from their own moral awareness. What he seems to be arguing there is that, okay, if you really want to know yourself, know who you are, and know what it means to be you, you gotta let it all out so mm-hmm. that you can acknowledge it. The worst thing you can do is hide yourself from yourself. And that gets back to what I think Art's claim was. Sometimes, all right, Art was really sort of creeped out by the fact that the mind goes where it's going to go, regardless of how you can rein it in. But what Montaigne seems to be arguing here is that, well, there's no control over this. Sometimes we do things thoughtlessly or without cognition. The way to combat the negative effects of that, and there are negative effects, is to step back for a second, admit to ourselves who we are, and then sort of go forth with that. Now, I think there can be a kind of false candor or a fake candor mm-hmm. that's sort of constructed to admit these things, to let yourself off the hook. And perhaps Montaigne is participating in that. I really don't know. I never met the guy. I'm thinking in some ways sort of how I don't want to step into this, but to use a contemporary example, after the sort of revelations about Louis C.K. came out, mm-hmm. What were revelations or what were perhaps, I don't know, But after that came out, there was a lot of critique of his stand-up as being manufactured in a way to mitigate those things.
Huh, yeah.
To say that, well, okay, I'm a horrible human being, but I'm admitting to myself that I'm a horrible human being. But right. If it's a manufacturing, it's not the admitting. I think what Montaigne is getting at here is a kind of true recognition and cognition of all of your faults, as well as all of your achievements, to sort of figure out, okay, this is what it means to be human in a much more complicated way than just sculpting your vices into a performance.
Yeah, absolutely. That's far deeper than the than the passage I found that I was thinking of. But I think it at least illustrates another direction that Montaigne's coming at the candor issue.
Yeah.
I think another argument that he's making, I suppose, about it.
But go says, to that passage. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. But he says here, but let us come to my subject. What has the act of generation, so natural, so necessary, and so just, done to men to be a thing not to be spoken of without blushing and to be excluded from all serious and moderate discourse? We boldly pronounce kill, rob, betray, and that we dare only to do what twixt the teeth. Is it to say the less we expend in words, we may pay so much more in thinking? For it is certain that the words least in use, most seldom written, and best kept in, are the best and most generally known. And I really love that passage because I think he's coming at the I think this is another sort of like I said, I think it's a less profound argument for the candor thing, but I think he's saying, like, look, we talk all the time about things that are unpleasant, about things that should be embarrassing and that should make us blush, things like robbery and betrayal and killing. That should be what we're embarrassed about as people, but we're not. We speak proudly and openly about that stuff. But the moment we start talking about something that we do to enjoy each other, we get all bashful. And I thought that was interesting because that's an argument that that's something we still talk about today. I mean, I think you said we were talking in the, kind of the previous chats that you mentioned, like that was kind of Howard Stern's shtick for a while in the 90s. This kind of like pointing out that kind of hypocrisy. And I thought it was interesting that Montaigne was, you know, even way back when was making the same sort of argument for candor from this, like, look, we already, like, you know, the cat's out of the bag on all this awful stuff. Why can't we be similarly open about something that we, you know, that is actually good in the world?
You know? Yeah. And I think Matt in the previous discussions was really sort of right. I would view Howard Stern as someone who's sculpting his vices into a performance. And Matt really sort of wanted to argue that Montaigne is not sculpting. There's something about this in the essay or the attempt that's just sort of like, here's something I do that fascinates me. Let me write about it. Yeah. I mean, in experience or in on experience, he gives detailed information about when you should have your bowel movements and why that is the perfect time.
Right.
That seems to come not necessarily from scatological information as comedic leveling, but rather, here is my advice to the world.
Mm-hmm.
Here's how it functions for me. Take what you will. So I think it's kind of interesting to get into the sort of, if he's talking about this as a human thing, he's addressing it in gendered terms, but he's also being very, very open about the genders. He's giving this example of why we should sort of be open to the idea of sexual desire. or at least open to the experiences of women. So he says there was that plea lodged in Catalonia by a wife as plaintiff against her husband's excessive assiduous lovemaking. Not, I think, because she was actually troubled by it. Okay, that's where his sort of misogyny is coming in. Yeah. But rather to have a pretext for pruning back and curbing the authority of husbands over their wives, even in the very deed which forms the basic act of marriage, and also to show that the nagging and spitefulness of wives extend over the marriage bed and trample under the under heel the sweet delight of Venus. Her husband, a really depraved brute of a fellow, made the rejoinder that even on days of abstinence, he could not manage with less than 10 times. Okay, so on the one hand, he's opening this up. Well, you know, women will do anything to get power in a marriage. On the other hand, this guy really, I mean, that's nuts.
Yeah.
Whereupon intervened the notable judgment of the Queen of Aragon, after mature deliberation in her council, that good queen, wishing to provide for all time an example of the moderation required in a proper marriage and a measuring rod for temperance, ordained that it is necessary to limit and restrict intercourse to 6 times a day, sacrificing much of women's needs and surrendering many of their desires in order to establish a scale which would be unexacting and therefore durable and unchanging, at which the doctors exclaimed, "If that is the rate assessed by a reasoned moral reformation, what must be the lusts and the appetites of women? Just think of the disparity of judgments on our appetites." Solon, the head of the school of lawgivers, with the aim of avoiding failure, sets the rate for such conjugal intimacy at 3 times a month. "We believe all that and teach all that, and then we go and assign sexual restraint to women as something peculiarly theirs, under pain of punishments of the utmost severity. No passion is more urgent than this one, yet our will is that they alone should resist it, not simply as a vice with its true dimensions, but as an abomination and a curse worse than impiety and parricide. Meanwhile, we men can give way to it without blame or reproach." What he's sort of pointing to there is the way that this misogynistic discourse puts all the blame on women. They're too horny and they can't control themselves.
Yeah.
Well, okay, which one is it?
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, that's what I find kind of fascinating about this essay is that, okay, he's not exactly what we would call woke Montaigne.
Right.
But he is pointing to the logical inconsistency of a lot of these misogynistic attitudes. And that's what I think is really sort of worth it in this essay. I think you pointed it out rightly. What he seems to be arguing for is a kind of open marriage, a sort of polyamory that views the institution of marriage itself as pragmatic and practical.
Yeah, like a grounding institution.
Yeah. Yeah. But one which does not account for all of the proclivities that we might have as humans, male and female. And while I can't necessarily say that that's something that I could go through with, it seems to be admirable, or it seems to me admirable, that he can think in that way.
Yeah, I think so. I think that puts a nice bow on some lines of Virgil.
Yeah, small penises and all.
Yeah.
So I suppose let's move to on physiognomy and his kinds of interest there in what exactly is going on in the wars in France. And yeah. Did you want to take sort of 5 seconds to talk one more time? I think we addressed this before, but if you want to get everyone up to speed about what exactly was going on in the religious wars at that point.
Right. So I believe at the time Montaigne is writing this third batch of essays, he's more advanced in life. It's, I believe, in the 1570s, I want to say. And
yeah, I think he claims to be 56 at this point.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I meant like the decade that he's writing in.
Right
from his birthday. Gotcha.
Yeah.
but yeah, so at this point, we've had, you know, what, 60 years? You know, two generations of Reformation has been sort of roiling through Europe. It's you've had sort of the settlement of Augsburg in the Holy Roman Empire has kind of helped things settle down over there. But in France, though, and something to remember about this early stage of the Reformation is that this is really before the idea that you would be a Protestant or a Catholic. This is actually Europe is undergoing, and France in particular is undergoing, the process by which those identities are formed and crystallize. And how they are formed and how they crystallize are largely through mass violence. Because what you have happening in France at this time, remember that the struggle in the Reformation to begin with was not splitting off. It was reforming, literally. It was the idea that something has gone wrong with the one universal Holy Church. I know how we can fix it, that I, being variously Luther, Zwingli, Calvin, what have you, I know how to fix it. So all we need to do to ensure the salvation of our immortal souls is to start doing church the way I think it should be done, or rather the Bible says it should be done, which I have helpfully interpreted for you.
So a fighting of totalitarianism with totalitarianism.
Essentially, yes, but really fought out in a kind of almost lawyerly fashion through these arguments and counterarguments, except, of course, when when push comes to shove and you have things becoming enforced. And the Peace of Augsburg kind of set the stage for this more forceful, this more directly violent Reformation, because it established the doctrine of I forget the Latin motto for it, but the doctrine was essentially, as the prince decides, so the realm abides. So that rather than basically, so all these arguments would be hashed out, but whoever is in charge of whatever district you're in, be they a bishop or a count elector or, you know, whatever, the various independent polities in this checkerboard of the Holy Roman Empire in Central Europe at the time, whatever he decides, that's what the church in that area will be. So that's what everyone has to go to. And so, of course, in order to accomplish that, all these various, you know, lords and feudal magnates and whatever, you're going to have to go in and rough up the priests who don't go along with your Lutheran vision, or rough up the priests who think that the church should be reformed and don't want to go back to following the Roman Catholic doctrine. And that's kind of setting the stage in France right now. France is in this foment, in large, a lot of it being fueled by John Calvin, who was a Frenchman. He's most associated with sort of Switzerland and Geneva, because that's where he, after getting kicked out of France, that's where he set himself up. And it's interesting that sort of Calvin has this reputation of being like the tyrant of Geneva, and that he sort of set up a theocracy and whatnot. But the thing to remember is that he was invited there. He was a famous guy who seemed to have very clear ideas on what God wanted from them. You know, here's a guy who seems to understand what God wants in a church. Let's invite him here and he can help us. Which he then of sort, you know, made into this kind of theocratic situation. But anyway, so John Calvin's writing in French. A lot of his ideas are permeating into France. And what's going on is that a lot of the sort of we sort of have this idea, especially in France, of Protestantism being a bottom up kind of thing, that they were sort of, you know, secret cells of Protestants that were being, you know, crushed by the Catholic hierarchy. But to begin with, it was very much an upper class phenomenon, because, you know, who had the time to sit around and read theological treatises? It was the upper class. Right. It was people like Montaigne. So that's where a lot of the support started coming in. And so, you know, once you have like a, you know, some big landed magnate decides he wants to support Protestantism, and he has all, you know, all the churches in his region, like, oh, hey, you guys, you should start doing this. That starts getting the common people involved a little more. But eventually, you know, it comes to the head, because you're right. It was that totalitarianism versus totalitarianism. Who is going to be in charge of the church in France? Right. Because everyone was still, at this point, everyone was still convinced that there was just one church. No one was breaking off of anything. So this is the sort of tinderbox situation going on. It really explodes in the 1570s with an event called the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, which was occasioned by, you know, it's very complicated to go into. I think I might have been in an earlier episode, but essentially a very famous Protestant high muckety muck, an admiral, dared show up to a big royal wedding in Paris and sort of making himself vulnerable to arrest or otherwise assassination by rival partisans, which he was then assassinated. And so the Protestant communities, and this is really when you first have a sense of Protestant communities, because these were now people who held Protestant opinions, felt like they were under attack from all the other people around them. That's a powerful bonding kind of force. That's a powerful way to crystallize an identity. And sadly, the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre was an extreme bloodletting on the part of what we might call traditionalist Christians against these Protestants who they felt were somehow involved in a kind of scheme to overturn everything. So it was, you know, kind of fifth columnists. We have to purge them. And that just kicked off this intense cycle of massacre and counter massacre, where instead of it being this sort of war of ideas fought out among pamphlets being circulated, it literally became a war of fire and steel, and places were won over to this church or that through fire and steel. And this is the situation that we're in France at the time. Yeah.
And that's what's sort of fascinating, is that Montaigne has he's throughout on physiognomy, he's doing his best to maintain a kind of nonpartisan stance. It's not exactly neutral.
Right.
Neutrality means that you haven't picked a side, and he has picked a side. He's conscientious here in terms of, okay, this is what I truly believe is the right way to go. And the right way to go for Montaigne is 99% pragmatic center way. But what he points out is the way that his pragmatism is viewed as partisanship by each side.
Right. Yeah. It's
there's a part in particular that's not necessarily about that, but about his analysis of the rebellion itself. And on the idea of reformation, he says, "I often doubt whether among all those who engage in such disorders, there's ever been found one man who was so feeble of understanding that he actually let himself be convinced that he was advancing towards reformation by way of the ultimate in deformation, that he was ensuring his salvation by means of the most explicit causes we know of most certain damnation, or that by overthrowing the Constitution, the authorities and the laws under the tutelage of which God has placed him, and by the dismembering of his motherland, tossing parts of her to be gnawed by her ancient foes, filling brotherly hearts with parasitical hatreds, and summoning up devils and the furies to help him, he can somehow bring succor to the most holy loveliness and justice of God's words. Ambition, greed, cruelty, revenge do not have enough natural violence on their own, so let us light the match and stir the fire under the glorious pretext of justice and devotion. Mm-hmm. No worse state of affairs can be imagined than one in which wickedness becomes lawful, donning, by leave of the magistrate, the mantle of authority." Under the rubric of reformation of purity, we have absolute destruction.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that sort of gets at my own animosity towards purity. Anytime anyone begins talking about purity, maybe it's because I'm 40 years old. I don't know. I'm an old man now. But anyone, I think Roberto Bolaño in one of his stories writes about how purity is an adolescent obsession. It's something 14-year-olds want. Mm-hmm. And for me, it sort of seems the same thing. And that speaks to the heart of Montaigne's project, and maybe why I'm kind of simpatico with it, mm-hmm. is we're a mess.
Yeah.
To be human is to be a mess. There's no such thing as purity. And when you're purifying yourself, you're sort of dismembering yourself. You're cutting yourself off from your actual practices, or cordoning them off as not part of yourself. You're making yourself something other than human. And it's extraordinarily destructive. And we can see it in the politics of our own day.
Mm-hmm. I'm very much with you. I've determined that the pursuit of purity and the idea of purity is it's a mug's game. It's no good.
No, it's fascism.
Exactly. Well, I was going to say,
throw down. It's fascist.
I once got into it in the comments on a BBC article on Twitter where I was basically like, you know, explaining to some racist prick that, you know, the vaunted racial purity of it was some kind of like archaeological find about Vikings. And of course, anytime Vikings come up, some fascist prick's going to get involved. But I was kind of explaining like, nah, bruh, like whatever imagined racial purity you think existed then is absolutely never happened. And it certainly isn't around now. Everyone has been mixing since every time everywhere. There's no such thing as purity. No one needs to even worry about it. And then, it was fruitless to argue it, but I just couldn't let that lie because who cares? Who cares?
I'll go back to what I took an anthropology class in my freshman year, and I had this great professor who was kind of like a lunatic. He was one of those old guy lunatics, but he was a fascinating lunatic, and he said, you know, bluntly, it was a 9 o'clock class. Maybe he was just trying to wake us up, but I think he had a point. We were talking about intermixing between cultures, and he said, "Look, I'll be honest with you. From all the reading I've done in this field since I've been 20, there's what I like to call the fuck to fight ratio, and 9 times out of 10." It's fuck, and that 1 time out of 10, it's fight. There's more of a chance that groups are going to intermingle and mix than there is that they're going to sort of fight it out for some kind of like purity cause,
right? Like have some sort of have this opposition. But to bring it back to Montaigne, But yeah, this mention of what this kind of struggle inflicts upon the very body it's attempting to purify, as a question that Montaigne is interested in, and he also drops some biographical sort of updates on how his estate has been faring in all of this, where he writes, "I was writing this about the time when a great load of our intestine troubles for several months lay with all its weight upon me. I had the enemy at my door on one side, and the freebooters, worse enemies, on the other." Freebooters being kind of opportunistic bandits in this, you know, times of chaos. "And underwent all sorts of military injuries all at once. A monstrous war. Other wars are bent against strangers, this against itself, destroying itself with its own poison. It is of so malignant and ruinous a nature that it ruins itself with the rest, and with its own rage mangles and tears itself to pieces. We more often see it dissolve of itself than through scarcity of any necessary thing or by force of the enemy. All discipline evades it. It comes to compose sedition, and is itself full of it, would chastise disobedience, and is itself the example. And employed for the defense of the laws, rebels against its own. What a condition we are in. Our physic makes us sick." And I think that's powerful because he's bemoaning the... And it really can cut both ways. I read it mostly as bemoaning the official response to what began basically as a kind of self-defense move by this emerging consciously Protestant community. By the state and by official organs, that, you know, in opposing sedition, it comes to compose sedition, you know, in employed for the defense of the laws, it rebels against its own. And yet at the same time, I think that's a charge that can be leveled at these Protestants, you know, who are supposed – who are ostensibly fighting for a kind of a higher society, a more godly society as they see it. And they're going about it in the way of just, you know, fire and blood and rapine and theft. That it's the kind of it's the kind of situation that I guess the it's almost – I hate to say this because it sounds very glib. But it's the kind of situation that's almost made for a man like Montaigne. And not so much standing aloof from it, but in navigating it with that kind of – or rather at least being concerned that he has the compass to navigate it. And he's drawing on the humanist on the humanist sources and his own observation, his own sort of epistemology that he's developing in order to – navigate it.
And that's what, like, that's what I think is kind of fascinating. I believe Matt addressed some of the problems he had with the church, or he almost got into trouble with the church, though they sort of negotiated their way out of that. But one of the things he does is say, I will navigate this to the best of my ability, but at a certain point, he says, besides, by my nature, I'm neither very suspicious nor distrustful, and that is the truth. I have a strong tendency to find justifications and the kindest interpretation. I judge men according to the common order of nature. I do not believe in perverted and disnatured tendencies any more than important portents and miracles, unless I'm forced to do so by some major piece of evidence. So, you know, supernatural shit, maybe it's there, I don't know. If I see it, yeah, sure. I am, moreover, a man inclined to trust myself to fortune and to allow myself to dash into her arms. Up to the present, I have had more reason to congratulate myself on that than to pity myself, and I have found fortune both better informed and better disposed towards my affairs than I am. There have been a few deeds in my life, the handling of which could rightly be called difficult or, if you wish, wise. Allow even a third of those to be due to me, but two-thirds certainly were abundantly to her. Chance dictates. The circumstances dictate, and you maneuver according to the circumstances. This sounds close to something like chaos theory, which is not the, you know, wow, hurricane because a butterfly flapped its wings. No. Chaos theory is a mathematical principle, claims that we can typically know certain kinds of broad parameters up to a point. Mm-hmm. But the maneuvers that happen within those parameters are unknowable.
Yeah.
And those movements affect where those parameters will go eventually. So it's sort of like, look, there are certain ways that I can navigate what I can.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, I just do my best.
But yeah, I guess speaking of, of navigation, I don't know if it's too early to move on experience, or were there other elements?
Well, there's one last thing that I would want to say is that it's his calling on fortune. Later, he mitigates that by saying, well, heaven. Okay. God has a plan. I can't see it. Yeah, you know, whatever. But it was that moment of fortune, chaos, chance. He opens that up. Later he'll say, you know, it's up to heaven what will happen, which is sort of like, okay, maybe there is a plan, but I can't see it. I can't know it.
Right.
But it's still that humility of saying, I can only do within my circumstances what I can do.
Right.
The rest is up to me. And and that really speaks to his epistemology, which I think leads us into experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I want to start out with on experience because he throws down the claim at the very beginning. No desire is more natural than the desire for knowledge. We essay all the means that can lead us to it. When reason fails us, we make use of experience. And then he has a quote, by repeated practice and with examples showing the way, experience constructs an art. Experience is a weaker and less dignified means, but truth is so great a matter that we must not disdain any method which leads us to it. So what he's laying out from the beginning is that it's our own personal subjectivity which gets us to understand what exactly the world is. Mm-hmm. And it's that that we have to trust on rather than some sort of idealist proposition. The induction, reason has so many forms that we do not know which to resort to. Experience has no fewer. The induction which we wish to draw from the likeness between events is unsure since they all show unlikenesses. When collating objects, no quality is so universal as diversity and variety. As the most explicit example of likeness, the Greeks, Latins, and we ourselves allude to that of eggs. Yet there was a man of Delphi who, among others, who recognized the signs of difference between eggs and never mistook one for another. When there were several hens, he could tell which egg came from which. Of itself, unlikeness obtrudes into anything we make. No art can achieve likeness. The reason he seems to be interested in experience is because no experience is like any other experience.
Yeah.
This is Nietzsche. Nietzsche, in essay after essay after essay, if you want to find where he really sort of writes about it, it's Truth and Lies in a Non-Moral Sense. It's a very brief essay. But he lays out the claim that because concepts are so broad, they're ideological concepts,
yeah,
they eliminate the significant differences between events, ideas, experiences, so on and so forth, they're falsifications.
Yeah.
And what Nietzsche seems to be drawing from Montaigne, and Nietzsche read his Montaigne, Nietzsche read Emerson, Emerson read his Montaigne, is that there is no unifying truth to the universe. There's only the subjective experience. I don't think Montaigne goes that far. I think Montaigne wants to say there are certain parameters that past knowing can help us develop.
Yeah.
But Montaigne really does come down on the side of, look, everything is ultimately different. So to put everything together into a sameness is a falsification, so rely on your own experience.
Yeah, it's well, one might use that great boogeyman word postmodern to describe mm-hmm. such a kind of conception. But yeah, you're absolutely right. And I was struck by reading it that it's staking out, or rather, he's sort of carrying the flag for an earlier philosophical position. That again, you'd be surprised. All of the sorry to kick around the fascists some more, but all these I'm anti postmodern dipshits with Greek statues and their avatars and all that, talking about like, oh well, Western civilization used to have concrete bases and stuff back in the Middle Ages. Let me tell you something about Middle Ages philosophy. There is a school called nominalism, buddy, and the nominalists rejected the idea of there being anything like abstract realities. There was no such thing as – they rejected Platonism essentially in the sense that they held the view that anytime there's any sort of like collective or general noun that they called, the nomina, the kind of a name that we have for things, that's just because we decided enough things look similar enough that we'll use the same word for them. But there isn't an actual unifying reality about them. And yeah. I think Montaigne is sort of carrying that flag, and you're right. And I think, Emerson and Nietzsche will pick it up, and then, they'll pick up that flag and wave it a little harder than Montaigne is willing to, because he hedges himself by saying that, like, oh, yes, well, sometimes we have to rely on experience. I mean, it's not nearly as good as reason. No, let's not go crazy. But you're right. He's staking out a pretty radical position that he's not quite his reach extends his grasp as far as he's willing to go.
Yeah, I mean, okay, and that gets – let me get on my high horse. That gets to my other bugbear about, you know, oh, these postmodernists and moral relativism and, oh, you have no morals. No, just because you put your own expectations aside for a moment does not mean that you're not considering, thinking through – contemplating the ethical implications of action X, Y, or Z. It doesn't mean an absolute acceptance of all in this kind of totalizing way. What it means is often for the moment when observing or encountering something that's beyond your own epistemological or ontological framework, you give it the benefit of the doubt. That is extraordinarily different than saying, hey, man, it's okay to do that if, like, you know, things are cool. No.
Yeah, yeah.
This is not some kind of wishy-washy stupidity. In fact, I would argue that it's a lot more strenuous in its intellectual activity than a kind of yes, no, binary, you know, what have you. I'm sorry. I'm irritated by Fox News.
No, I think you're right. Like I think there's a kind of, it's having the wherewithal to admit with integrity the limits of your own possibility of your understanding.
Yes, there you go. And I think, pulling it into the nominist and the other sort of strains of philosophy that are going to this is really sort of helpful. Okay, so there's the Nietzschean epistemology, then there's the sort of Emersonian individuality. This is sort of in this moment where he says, oh, well, this gets at both. He says, out of one subject, we make a thousand and sink into Epicurus' infinitude of atoms by proliferation and subdivision. Never did two men ever judge identically about anything, and it is impossible to find two opinions which are exactly alike, not only in different men, but in the same men at different times. I normally find matter for doubt in which the gloss has not condescended to touch upon. Like certain horses, I know which miss their footing on a level path. I stumble more easily on the flat. Okay, what he's talking about is glosses and sort of analyses of texts that are attached to those texts, mm-hmm. Footnotes, annotations, so on and so forth. What strikes me here is the way that he comes so close to that Whitmanian rereading of Emerson, so I contradict myself, so what?
Yeah, yeah.
If you're going to be completely honest with yourself, in different circumstances, you may think one thing, and in a different circumstance or in another circumstance, you may think the antithesis of that thing or react antithetically to the way that you assume you would react. So I contradict myself? Okay, fine. I had a teacher in high school who was a parent who told me once that you never think you will, you know, he was an intellectual. He was an extraordinarily intelligent guy. He was one of the best teachers I ever had. And he said, you never think that you'll tell your child because I said so. But as soon as you have a child, you will discipline that child and your rationale will be because I said so.
Right.
I can see it happening now.
Yeah.
My son is 1.5. I know it will happen. I like to think of myself as someone who gives a reason for the things that he does, but I know my son's capacities, and I know at 3 I will scream at him because I said so. Go to bed. Why? Because I said so.
Yeah.
There are ways in which we contradict who and what we assume, according to broad parameters, we are or we would do. And this goes back to Montaigne's humanism. We contradict ourselves. That's Emerson.
Mm-hmm.
Emerson ripped it off. I have a certain animus against Emerson. And he grates on me in certain circumstances. And I just want to point out that Emerson, with his ideas of absolute originality, absolutely ripped off Montaigne. Okay, so to keep going forward... this, again, is another passage that could have come right out of Emerson. It is only our individual weakness which makes us satisfied with what has been discovered by others or by ourselves in this hunt for knowledge. An abler man will not be satisfied with it. There's always room for a successor, yes, even for ourselves, and a different way to proceed. There's no end to our inquiries. Our end is in the next world. Emerson ripped that off.
Yeah.
This is the difference between Emerson and Montaigne. Montaigne wants to. It sounds more positive in Montaigne.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like an admission that look, when you get satisfied by the thought of another, then you sort of let your own guard down and become something that you're not. Eventually you'll figure out that that's not your knowledge, that's someone else's knowledge from his own experience. So gauge it on what you are, but also be open to the possibility that you will change your mind. Emerson has much more of an agonistic relationship with past writing, where he wants to proclaim this kind of like absolute or totalitarian individualism, where any kind of past writing which tells you something about who and what you are, or that does it in a sort of fascinating or intense way, a sublime way that gets at, you know, something above and beyond how you could think, well, it's an insult to you.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this antagonistic sort of relationship to other writing, and Emerson has to keep writing his originality. When you look at his sources, the more he, and his source being Montaigne, the more Emerson insists on originality, the less original he looks. It's really kind of fascinating. That's what was so interesting to me about On Experience. And the other thing is the way that Montaigne tempers it. Because Montaigne keeps coming back to that Platonic or, well, maybe not Platonic, but Socratic ideal.
Yeah.
Of moderation. Just keep it in the middle road. Look, the extremes on either side are going to get you into trouble. Always acknowledge that coming back to the middle road is probably going to be the healthiest.
Yeah.
And that might be a moment where we could sort of pull aside and say he's not exactly Platonic, though he is Socratic.
Mm-hmm.
The Platonic ideal is much more involved in sort of the abstract form of things. And Montaigne really has very little patience for the abstract form of things. He's much more interested in the concrete details and in the sort of everydayness of it all. Not to step back too far into On Physiognomy, but one of the parts of On Physiognomy is where he puts his own words into Socrates' mouth. He sort of recycles some of the past essays as to put it into Socrates talking about how to live and how to die.
Yeah.
And the point that he's trying to make about Socrates, or the point that he sort of comes back to, is that Socrates is not complicated. If you read Plato's writing on Socrates, Socrates doesn't talk about complicated things in complicated ways. He talks about complicated things in extraordinarily simple ways, in very easy to understand ways. He's not trying to show off his learning in this kind of obfuscation. He's trying to bring thinking down to the level of experience. Mm-hmm. At least that's Montaigne's claim. And that's why I think he finds Socrates so interesting, as opposed to Plato, who through Socrates wants to sort of establish this world of forms.
Right, like sort of Plato kind of taking the pretense of being the fulfillment of the Socratic method and epistemology, basically. Like, you know, Plato, like, yeah. Okay, Socrates started this program. I'm going to finish. Let's see, Socrates pointed the way and I shall walk it for you. You know, when really, yeah, like Montaigne is much more sympathetic to, no, let's go back to a guy who's pointing the way because maybe I want to walk my way rather than Plato's.
Yeah. And I mean, and that gets at, okay, this is another moment that is Nietzsche all over. Now, laws remain respected not because they are just, but because they are laws. That is the mystical basis of their authority. They have no other. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a throwaway line in Montaigne that becomes a whole essay by Nietzsche on the genealogy of morality. Okay, this is the difference between Montaigne and Nietzsche. Montaigne says laws are arbitrary. They're just customs. Pragmatically, the best thing to do is to go along with them to the degree that you can. What laws you think you can't abide by, perhaps break them privately, but put on a good show, would you? Mm-hmm. It's all about survival, I think, in some ways. And Nietzsche, from his acknowledgement that all laws are, well, in his terms, morality from mores, this transcendental morality is nothing but custom. So break it all.
Yeah, yeah.
Montaigne would say, that's stupid. Have a glass of wine. It's kind of like there's this tempering in Montaigne that I really sort of admire. It can be problematic because there are certain points at which you want to say that unjust laws made unjustly should be altered and changed. And there's not much in Montaigne which would allow you to articulate that. But the Nietzschean Übermensch ideal, I mean, it's an adolescent fantasy.
Yeah, well, it's kind of – I realized you were just talking. I was reminded – to bring it down to the level of dumbness, which I am accustomed to. I was reminded of one of my favorite internet memes I've ever seen in my life, where it was like two panels. And on the one side, it said something like, you know, the universe is meaningless. Nothing matters. And it was like a all blacks and whites and some dreary looking fellow looking down and serious and very Nietzschean. And the other panel was on the other side with a bright and cheery guy in sunglasses giving a mighty thumbs up. And it said, the universe is meaningless. Nothing matters.
And there you go.
And yeah, and I very much like, God, I loved it. And yeah, you have Nietzsche versus Montaigne.
Well, I think it's also interesting the time periods in which they lived. Montaigne's situation was one of extreme external chaos. Nietzsche's was one of relative calm.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks to, well, their experiences and to their reactions to this. There are other moments that remind me of certain other writers. One is Joseph Conrad in this weird, weird way. He writes about the way that he's bothered by law because of the way it seems to be abstractly written and overly complicated. Mm-hmm. But that opens up this idea of how do you know what's right and wrong? Conrad in his writing in the early part of his writing when he was an impressionist was using impressionism, like the idea that the text could make you feel something, mm-hmm. as a kind of moral force, which is why Heart of Darkness is so weird. Marlowe cannot transmit the subjective truth of his experiences of what sound to me like PTSD. He has to work circuitously. He can't tie up his experiences in the Congo in a neat, nice little bow for the other members of that ship that he's talking to. So he has to tell them his feeling about the things. And there are moments where Montaigne seems to sort of similarly suggest that. There's this way in which he wants to say that experience itself is the feeling of what is right or wrong. And that I thought was really sort of – it's interesting and it's problematic because if feeling is what makes something ethical or unethical, then how do you transmit that? Mm-hmm. How do you know that? But there's another, you know, I guess we're sort of rounding out on experience, but there's another moment that I thought was really, really interesting. He writes about learning how to suffer, mm-hmm. and he writes about, you know, his problems with kidney stones. And he essentially sort of says that the cure is often worse than the symptom. So part of what you have to do with an illness is learn how to deal with it.
Yeah.
And he has a section on scabies, which I thought was really sort of interesting. I cannot recall ever having had scabies, but scratching is one of the most delightful of nature's bounties, and it is always ready to hand. But its neighbor, inconveniently close, is regret for having done it. I mainly practice it on my ears, which from time to time itch inside. Okay, it's a bizarre throwaway line, but it reminded me so much of the Samuel Beckett short story, The End. Mm-hmm. Beckett, at this point of in his career, was waging war with logic. He viewed logic as a useful pragmatic tool up to a point, but there was no transcendence to it. So after World War II, he started writing these first short stories and then novels that move by non sequitur. Like the whole point of a non sequitur is that it's a leap in logic and that it is literally illogical.
Right.
It doesn't follow. So in Beckett's writing, the non sequitur signals this move that suggests that the nature of the universe is absolutely chaotic. And it was kind of stunning to me because this particular passage of description of scratching scabies in Montaigne sounded so much like this passage of Beckett in The End. This, mm-hmm. this, by the way, is one of my favorite short stories of all time. And I'm going to risk a lawsuit by sort of reciting a passage. I don't have anything that you could take. So if you want to sue me, you'll get nothing. All right. So here goes. The narrator in The End is a homeless person who just moves from point to point to point to point to point chaotically with no real understanding. And so he's describing essentially his occupation of begging. You should never wear gloves either. There were gutter snipes who swept away all that I had earned under cover of giving me a coin. It was to buy sweets. I unbuttoned my trousers discreetly to scratch myself. I scratched myself in an upward direction with four nails. I pulled on the hairs to get relief. It passed the time. Time flew when I scratched myself. Real scratching is superior to masturbation, in my opinion. One can masturbate up to the age of 70 and even beyond, but in the end, it becomes a mere habit. Whereas to scratch myself properly, I would have needed a dozen hands. I itched all over on the privates in the bush, up to the navel, under the arms and the arse, and then patches of eczema and psoriasis that I could set raging merely by thinking of them. It was in the arse I had the most pleasure. I stuck my forefinger up to the knuckle. Later, if I had to shit, the pain was atrocious. But I hardly shout anymore. Now and then a flying machine flew by sluggishly, it seemed to me. Okay, the reason I wanted to recite that is because, one, it reminded me of Montaigne talking about the pleasure of scratching while you have scabies. But it also reminded me of the weird fascination that Montaigne has for all things physical. And yeah. And this point that he keeps making about how we shouldn't disabuse the physical. We shouldn't cut ourselves off from the physical. And he has some brilliant passages in all three essays that we're talking about tonight on not cutting yourself off from pleasure. To deny yourself pleasure is to deny yourself, I think, what he thinks would be part of the soul.
Yeah.
We weren't put here just to suffer. There are these things that we can do. Why not do them in moderation?
Right. Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And that's what he comes down to. Let's be honest. Let's be frank. But let's be moderate. Let's be not contained, but perhaps... And not controlled, but let's manage these things. And that's what I think is really sort of fascinating about this.
Yeah, if I had to sort of well, we can think of a metaphor with his sort of notion to your life experience is less like regimented rows of a plowed field and more like a gently tended garden. Perhaps.
Yeah.
Like it's within that, bounds. Yeah. It's, but it has its own wooliness to it, its own wildness to it. It is not regimented, but it is contained. I think actually, yeah, when our first attempt at this, I mentioned Epicurus, and I'm glad it actually came up in one of the quotations he reads that, he mentioned him there. And this is, I think Montaigne is reaching for the Epicurean ideal and not in the sense of the, how we use the term colloquially today, meaning, someone who enjoys food a lot, but rather the specific classical tradition that posited as a kind of a reaction to the philosophical hedonists who argued for always pursuing pleasure at all times. Whereas Epicurus and his followers were like, look, that's going to lead you into trouble instantly. How about you take a wider, expansive view of, you know, what your whole life is like and choose wisely how to enjoy that, but keep in mind the enjoyment.
Yeah. And that's what I think I found most refreshing about Montaigne. It's an epistemology dependent on doubt, but not so dependent that it allows for certain kinds of extraordinarily assholish behaviors. It's one that remains open to experience, but not so open that some kind of management is obliterated. It's one that admits that who we are is often beyond us, but we can catalog that, know it to a certain degree, and not contain it or master it, but work with it. It's a much more kind way of thinking about who we are. And despite how troubling, and I mean really troubling, some of the essays were that I think we talked about last time, I really had a good time reading this. It got to be a little bit of a slog.
Yeah,
to be completely honest, it's a very heavy book.
Yeah.
And Matt, I think, was right. But this is kind of, I think in our aborted episode, you'd mentioned that this was really sort of a bathroom reader. And
it's
kind of an intellectual bathroom reader. It's something that I want to come back to in a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. I'll give it a while. It's like when it's like when I got my undergrad degree. I was like, you know what? I could see myself going to school again, but not for a while.
I'm not dismissing this text. It's something I want to dip back into.
Yeah.
And I think as I lapse into old age, it might be something that I sort of keep on the bedside table.
Yeah.
It's not always the best, but it's full of a pithy saying or a solid 3 to 5 pages here and there that puts the chaos of existence into perspective in a way that will allow me to sleep better.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that Montaigne would approve of.
And what more could you ask of in a bedside book than that?
Well, yeah. All right. So, you know what? We have read Montaigne cover to cover.
Cover to cover, baby.
I feel like I've accomplished something. Our next episode is going to be the beginning of Don Quixote.
Yeah.
I am so looking forward to that.
Yes, it is. This is going to be terrific. And there's a little bit of a backstory to it, which I think we'll save for that episode. We can discuss our history with the text and our history with each other with the text when we record that one. But suffice to say, I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. I love Don Quixote. Okay, so I guess that's enough. Rate and review on iTunes if you feel like. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter. You can find us both on Facebook and Twitter. And check out the blog, thecannonballpodcast.wordpress.blog. I've been updating it a little bit more frequently to...
Yeah.
Most recently to sort of give a sense of how we're taking on the Western canon as a whole, just sort of the game plan for how we're planning to move forward. Cause we switched a couple of things around just logistically.
Right.
But, yeah, I think that if anyone's interested about how exactly we're sort of systematizing this, that has the best description. So.
And I would like to go ahead and make an on-air pledge to actually contribute to this blog. I fully intend to, because I love writing. I love writing, and I have not done it really. I haven't written anything like any kind of long form since grad school, like 4 years ago. So I really want to dip back in. And here's my pledge to you, the listeners, and to you, Claude. And the listeners can hold me accountable. I am going to contribute to this endeavor. Yes. But with that, yes, like Claude said, rate and review on iTunes, and yeah, guys, start reading Don Quixote.
All right. Well, I guess I'll talk to you in about a month, Daniel. We'll see how far we can get through Don Quixote.
Sounds great, man. Talk to you soon.
All right. Take care.